Audio.
We're going to start this podcast off with a very important and urgent message from our new sponsors.
Hello, my name is James Pompman, and I wanted to take a moment to let you know about the Council for Americans for Safe Seas and Oceans. We are a nonprofit foundation dedicated to making America's oceans and seas a safe place for men, women, and their families. 10 years ago, a killer whale ate my wife. We were enjoying a picnic on an empty beach when it leapt from the sea and swallowed her whole. By the time the police showed up, the whale was long gone, and because there were no witnesses, I was accused of murder and had to go to trial. Fortunately, I was acquitted. But even if I had gone to prison, I would still be spending every moment engaged in my life's work. That is, cleansing the ocean of all blackfish. Most people do not know that blackfish watch us from the sea as we sleep. Science has shown that they use sonar to send us subliminal messages through our TVs and radio that make us feel lonely and sad. Sometimes they even make us visit prostitutes or drink too much. Now, recently, a documentary called Blackfish came out and portrayed America's top fish prison, SeaWorld, as a terrible place. This foul work of liberal propaganda made these deadly manipulative fish seem like poor little puppy dogs. It also did not mention the fact that these orca compel us to wear women's heels at night when we are alone. Now, drugged-up eco-terrorists are using the same lies in this documentary to force SeaWorld to release its deadly killer whales back into the oceans. If they have their way, countless Americans could lose their lives or fall prey to the seduction of these devilfish and become drug addicts or cross-dressers or worse. So please, don't let this happen. Join me in the fight to keep America's top fish prison open. Please, at your earliest convenience, visit keepemlockedup.com and consider donating to this global movement dedicated to keeping our seas safe and family-friendly. See you at the beach!
And we are back. What a wonderful charity. I hope you guys will go to keepthemlockedup.com and donate as much money as you possibly can to this fantastic organization dedicated to keeping SeaWorld open and our oceans safe. Special announcement! Special announcement!
On May 24th, the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is paying a visit to the Hollywood Improv.
Incredible.
And you're invited for a night of violent pain.
Yes.
Your brain will be ripped from your skull. Your rib cage will be cracked open. You will be chopped into hamburger meat. You will be tortured and poisoned. Make sure to tell your family you're never going to see him again. Not after May 24th. Come on down to the Hollywood Improv. Tickets available at DuncanTrussell.com.
So please come to this show because it is going to be a spectacular. Not only are you going to get ripped to pieces, but everyone within six square blocks is going to be ripped to pieces by the extra-dimensional beings that come leaping through the portal we are going to rip in the fabric of space and time right there at the Improv. I can't guarantee that's going to happen, but I'm hoping it happens, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that it does. We will open a rift in the time-space continuum. We will be devoured by star dogs. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Shore Design T-shirts. Have you ever wondered what it might be like to become your wife or girlfriend's clitoris? Now you can find out. These shirts are so very soft, and because they've been soaked in dichloramide hydrofloatate, they will cause a genetic shift in your skin, and your bones will sprout millions and millions of nerves that will grow out of your flesh and into the shirt, fusing you together with fabric so soft that the only thing it compares to is swimming in the tears of Jesus. ShoreDesignT-shirts.com. Go there and look at these beautiful shirts. Beautiful designs. They're Sure Designs. Go to SureDesignT-shirts.com and put my name in and you'll get 10% off. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. If you go to DuncanTrussell.com, there's an Amazon portal. Go swimming through that sweet little portal the next time you're shopping at Amazon, and they give us a small percentage of whatever you buy. And finally, don't forget to go to the shop located at DuncanTrussell.com and pick up some Duncan Trussell Family Hour stuff. God, I don't... Listen, if you don't like the commercials, skip ahead. I feel really insecure about doing these commercials today for some reason, so I'm sorry. But skip ahead. Just jump past them. Simple. You don't have to send me a furious tweet. Send me nice tweets, please. Today's guest has been on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast several times before. He is a genius musician. He's the drummer in the band Ohm. He's also in my favorite band, the Holy Sons, and the Grails. He's a wonderful human being, and I hope that you will sit back, close your eyes, open your mouth, and blow an astral spit bubble filled with pure glory in his direction. Welcome, Emil Amos. Okay, we're here with Emil Amos. What's going on?
I have a deadline to turn in a pretty big record in maybe like a week or so. So I'm kind of just living like a freak in a basement with no light, just staring at a computer, just shit like that, you know.
You're deep in you're in the midst of an alchemical process. In the laboratory, lanterns flickering, the glow of your will being illuminated in that rectangle we call technology. How beautiful is that? It really is incredible, man. There are still wizards. Magic still happens. It's just that we understand how it works, so no one's that excited about it anymore, it seems like.
Magic. Yeah, magic is something I've been thinking about. I did this podcast all about music recently, and for the first time I described my daily ritual of music as a magical process, which I don't know. I must have been hung up for 15, 20 years too much enough to admit that or say that. But now all of a sudden I've kind of admitted it. That's all I think of it as. It's a magical process. I think there are good reasons why I was hung up about it, because to be ruthlessly honest, I mean, most of the people you hear talking about magic, not very magical people.
No shit.
What is that? You see it everywhere, but
that's,
you know,
so good.
Anytime like, I remember, this is like a horrible example, but I remember like having this cast of characters as I got the worst roommates in college. Like, somehow they would stick me with like the one guy no one would live with every time.
Yes.
And it was some sort of punishment, I think. And I remember the first day meeting like one of my final roommates. And I remember, he sees me bringing in like a keyboard or something, and he's like, "Oh, you know, that's going weird when somebody's like, you play music. Music is my forte." When people say that to you, it always seems like you're like, "Oh, great, you know, this is like this guy's going to be the opposite version of what he's telling me." Like we got the first argument we got in, he was telling me why Tracy Chapman was better than all the music I listened to or something.
Oh, man.
But you know that feeling where somebody announces to you like, "Oh, I'm like so into film. I'm so into David Lynch or something."
Yes.
You know, like, "Oh, great. This is going to be the most boring person at this party, you know."
Yep. Yeah, it's probably because the closer in you get to it, the less compelled you feel like talking about it. Because the closer you get into it, the more you become it. And I think it likes to stay pretty secret a lot of the times. Though it is fun to discuss it, it's a framing. It's just framing what's happening in a way that makes it not stagnant anymore. You know, like when you're engaged in whatever your job is or your life is, if you framed it according to the way that most people look at it, then you're in a pretty boring shithole. Like, it is pretty dull if you look at it from the point of view of just being in a kind of, like, here's a framing, here's an interesting framing that some black magician whispered in the ear of a dumbass. This life, you do the best you can and work real hard. You're not going to get everything you want, but just do the best you can and try hard and be happy with what you got. You got a mattress on the floor, you should just be happy with that, because some people in other parts of the world are in a much worse situation than you. And it's this kind of like, you know, that framing of the world where it's just you've given up, and if you've got like a bowl of gruel, you're supposed to feel happy with that. And if you want more than that, you're supposed to feel guilty or greedy or too ambitious. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I was thinking about it on the way here. We're taking a walk. I was thinking, like, you know, language itself is, you know, the central, furthest frontier of human life in its way. It has the ability to help us explore what life is, and in the most advanced ways that we can, you know. And it's there philosophically, especially like in a Heidegger or something, it's there to use as a tool to explore the unknown. And yet language itself is generally just used, like you're saying, to form diatribes and just to cul-de-sacs of non-thought and, like, you know, selling summations to each other and just repeating these robotic, you know, sayings or something that are supposed to sum up life, but really just cut off your ability to go into the new and the unknown, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man, that's so well said. And there's other summations, and those summations, that's where you start getting into the occult, or that's where you start getting into mysticism or esotericism. And these summations, you experiment at first, you know, like, instead of, like, you know how, because you've heard a lot of these summations so many times, they become meaningless too. For example, all is one, or the idea that everything is God. That's a summation that you've probably heard a million times. Everything is God. We are in God. God is all around us. You are God. Everything is God. Everything is this. God is the word we use for it, but it's, you know, the expression of infinity or something, the infinite expression of infinity. So, but if when you're on your walk, if you're walking, you could do it right now. You just look around and pretend that everything's God. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you actually do it instead of just hearing it and thinking, oh, logically that makes sense. You actually look around and do the experiment of, this car I'm sitting in is God, and the road is God, and the sky is God. And then not like this is God, not God in disguise. This is literally, you are in the flesh, or the expulsion of God matter into the universe, and you get yourself to see that just for a second, man. And you can see it, because you throw off the other paradigm, which is it's just all, like, you know, useless plasticky matter that you shouldn't care about much because nothing matters at all. But just for a quick second, you imagine, holy shit, this is some extra dimensional super being that I happen to be one tiny little part of. And that is so fun if you can pull it off just for a second, because it transforms your universe in that moment from this mundane place to a magical place.
Yes. I think that the part of what bonds us together as human beings is sort of an unfortunate thing, is that as grand as peak experience can be, and as amazing as revelation can be, we are all bonded together by the fact that no Einstein escapes basic daily confusion. You know, there's a reason why you were using a word like secret a second ago, like the definition of a cult, or like this, you know, and magic. It's all implied within those concepts that that this is exclusive knowledge, which, you know, the reason why it is exclusive, not exclusive to some people and not others necessarily, it's the reason why it's exclusive is because it hides from you. Your brain spends most of its day entangled in, you know, a really massive maze of, I don't even know what it necessarily is, but you don't feel as though, if your life is perfect, if everything is perfect, you still never feel as though it's perfect.
Yeah, well, the trick is to realize that feeling of imperfection is perfect.
Right.
You know, like, so, because it's like, it's just, you got, because if you think, like, oh, this thing I'm feeling right now, this is not perfect, then you have a conception of what you're supposed to be feeling like. You know, you have this idea of like, ah, now I know what that would feel like, what that perfection would feel like. The weird thing is to start going the other way and thinking like, oh, this feeling that I have up until this point in my life been translating as a kind of hidden despair, or a sense of not fitting in, or a feeling of deep anxiety or fear or whatever. You accept the fact that that feeling is as perfect as a star. It's as perfect as a constellation. It's as perfect as a bumblebee. It's just the form of perfection it's taken is not one that you're ready to accept. You're fighting against it. You know, you can't surrender to that one little piece, which is like, yeah, it kind of hurts.
Totally. I think, I mean, we talk about this all the time, but there's some inborn implication in thought or something that you will arrive on the other side of the act of thinking, that you'll think yourself into perfectness. Yes. Or something. It's always existed, you know. Human beings have always tried to go back into the womb or arrive in heaven. I mean, these concepts exist for a reason. I mean, heaven, it was invented for a specific reason. And to this day, people walk down the street thinking heaven is real. This is a metaphor for a perfect place. And I guess, I don't know where David Byrne got it, because it's beyond genius, but that idea that heaven is a place where nothing ever happens is that's genius. I mean, it's like poking a hole in this concept we needed to invent, you know, that it doesn't exist. It's incredible.
I have a divergent perspective on that. I think it does exist. It's so funny you're talking about heaven right now, because I was walking the dog today and I was thinking, oh, like, what if this is the heaven of that there's all these different types of heavens? Mm-hmm. And that the heaven that we're in right now is the heaven of remembering that you're everything. And that, because the potential here is to go from being a completely limited thing to waking up to the realization that you are everything. And that moment of waking up can maybe happen over infinite lifetimes, but it accelerates from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. And so the pain that we were talking about earlier is actually the fire that's like heating this, like, it's like the engine that run, like, heaven, the fires of hell run the engine of heaven, you know, like, so that this heaven that we're in right now is, interestingly enough, if it was a created place, it's just fun to imagine this, like, we're in heaven right now, and this is a created place, or this is a place that was part of a bigger idea, and it was an idea in the mind of some supremely intelligent being who's, like, what really efficient. So he figured out how to make this hell at the exact same time that it's heaven. You know what I mean? Like, why make two different places? Let's just make it a POV. Let's make it so that if your perspective is that you have forgotten who you really are, then you're going to be feeling like shit all the time. But then let's make it simultaneously where the moment you start waking up just a little bit to your true identity, suddenly you get these bursts of happiness unlike anything you felt during the entire time that you thought you were a limited thing. You get these reminders, these glimpses, these little, like, hellos from this force that you've known maybe forever. And then suddenly you're like, oh, shit, there you are. Oh, hi. And then it's gone again. You're back, you know, muddling through the day with that gnawing sense of, God damn it, I'll never be fucking happy, will I? Shit. Because you've forgotten again. You know what I'm saying? And then you remember again. And that's what this heaven is. And maybe it keeps expanding, expanding, expanding. And eventually, yeah, nothing's happening anymore. And then you go back to the beginning again. Who knows?
It seems, yeah. I mean, I guess in my world, it seems to kind of cancel out the need for the concept of heaven if heaven's on earth. I mean, that's a funny saying, heaven.
Heaven's on earth. Yeah,
heaven
this
on
is
earth.
Heaven.
Yeah, right.
This is heaven.
That also, like, reminds me of the, that's like a Viktor Frankl kind of Sartre occupation of France thing where, like, you know, in the deepest realms of hell are heavens too,
yes.
You know?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, man, that's it. That's it. That's the thing. It's just the weird trick here is that, you know, we are secretly in heaven. That's the secret. The secret isn't something about it's. That's like the biggest secret. It's the
sounds like you got a name for your next million selling book right there, buddy.
The biggest secret. We're in heaven. Yay! Let's go cheerleading on an angel's back. Let's catch an angel. Wouldn't that be fun? Oh, that'd be fun to catch an angel.
It's just funny, but
snare
that,
one.
That would and should sell a million copies, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, it's the cool thing about it is that it's like a one sentence book, because really,
the cool thing about it.
And so it's easy to write, but the fun thing about it is that, you know, the fun thing about all this is that it's a, you know, in again and again, and you hear about, like, in the New Testament, they're always talking about Jesus healing blind people and people going blind and getting their vision back and blind, blind, blind. But it is kind of like a blindness. It's like we're heaven blind, like the way some people are color blind. You're heaven blind. You can't see it.
Sure.
You walk around, you look at this incredible place. You're over it, man. You're used to it. You're used to flowers, trees, cars, electricity, internet. You're used to it. You got it all figured out, man. You totally get it. You've definitely figured out the entire thing. It's just normal. This explosion of matter into infinity. A goddamn paint mixer that from time to time wakes up in the form of human beings, of which you happen to be one. You've figured that out. You're totally cool with it. Not weird at all. No novelty at all. Just normal, mundane shit. You know what's going to happen 5 years from now. You know what's going to happen 20 years from now. You know how relationships work, what love is. You know how you deal with your mom. You know what I mean? That's like when you're in that place, this is a shithole. Because you've got it all figured out and it's goddamn boring. It's the David Byrne song. Nothing's happening.
Well, it's ironic that, I mean, not only are people who think everything is self-evident the most annoying people in the world, but but they're also, yeah, they, by definition, by knowing everything, somehow they achieve total stupidity.
It's like
a reverse intelligence. You sort of, like, the passion of life is gone all of a sudden, you know?
Yeah, they're ashen. They always have these ashen complexions, and they seem like, not only have they managed to just back themselves into the tiniest, tiniest little most boring corner in the fucking mansion, it's like people at the greatest party of all time, thrown by the most intelligent being that has ever been, and they've managed to find, like, a corner. Just one tiny corner, and they've turned their back to the party, and they're staring at that fucking tiny little corner, and they're like, yeah, I got this figured out. I know what this is. Just because they can't take how big the fucking party is, and they can't accept the fact that this thing is wild. You know, they want to be in control. You know, so anytime you start thinking like, ah, fuck, you know, God talk or waking up to God or finding God, if you've been listening to them and their explanation of what it is, the fundamentalists will tell you it's a really square, bearded, that old classic thing, a kind of boring, angry, bigoted dude, that's what God is. So of course you'd never want to find that guy, you'd never want to find God. But really, like, finding God is finding yourself, it's the exact same thing. And then you wake up to that and you're like, holy shit, man. This is wild. This isn't a thing that cares if I get high or doesn't get high or don't get high. Or this thing doesn't care if I have sex or don't have sex. This thing doesn't care if I'm... What I'm doing is always fine for this thing. Because it looks at all of this as just this perfect, perfect, beautiful, constantly changing thing. You know, and it sees that, I think it just is like, wow, this is fucking great, and it's just gonna get better and better and better. I don't know though.
That seems like a really advanced form of love that you know, God would put you into the universe and not judge you, but let you live by consequences of your own choices. That's a pretty beautiful form of love. You know, like, do anything you want, but then you have to live by it, you know?
It's the highest form, really. I mean, if you think about if you've ever been around somebody and you get that realization where they're just loving you no matter what you do.
Sure.
You know, even like when you fucked them over, you know, even like if you've ever even like done weird shit to them, you know, and they're still just right there with you. You know, it's a rare type of person, but it's a... You know, the reason those types of people are considered to be saints or divine people or gurus or enlightened beings is because they are representative of one of the most sophisticated ways of being, which is where you are truly loving everyone around you and not trying to stop them or control them or do anything other than let them do what they're doing. But you're loving them, that's all. You really are loving them. Whatever that is, you know. Love is another word. Love is a problemed word, just like God, just like enlightenment. It's the triad of confusing words, you know. They're all very confusing. So when you start saying love, you just start thinking about, I don't know, you start thinking about listening to the radio and tearing up on your way to work when you think about your ex-girlfriend or something, you know. That's not the love. That's not love.
This is a horrible question, but
I mean, I guess it should be love.
Someone somewhere is gonna enjoy it. Do you think that while someone who comes along and loves you unconditionally in this mind-blowing way like that, do you think that, I mean, clearly there's a sexual pull, there's a certain beautiful, a charisma to that. It's yes. Really powerful. You come into contact with it and you're like, damn, I want to be around that all the time.
Yes.
But do you think that there's also a dark side to sexual tension where you pursue people that you don't, that you actually don't want to be surrounded by? I mean, obviously there is, but like, what do you, have you thought a lot about that?
I read this thing by, I can't remember his name, man. Ron Rigi told me about this awesome thing on the internet, and it's all these like alchemical compendiums. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool, man. It's like all of the great grimoires and stuff are in there, are many of them. And I can't remember what I was reading now, man, but it was a quote where... that it's better to love poorly or mistakenly or wrongly. That's still better than anything else you can do. As long as you're, you know, moving in the direction of love. But what you're talking about, Ram Dass addresses a lot, and he says that sometimes we begin to objectify a person that we're pursuing, that we're attracted to. You objectify them instead of recognizing that they are what they really are, you know, their true identity, or you don't connect to the thing that's inside of them. You connect to the the ego, you know? It's like you connect to the whatever the most surface level aspect of them is, instead of recognizing that they're beings with souls and consciousness, and they deserve love. If you go at it like that, then, you know, hump till you're blue in the face. But, you know, if you're really, like, approaching somebody from that perspective, or even trying to, and overcoming that thing where you just, yeah, you do the thing where you turn somebody into a fleshlight. You know, you're just like, I'm here, we're just fucking. We're just gonna fuck. That's no fun. Just jerk off. Why are you using someone else's body for that?
Yeah, I think I know. I mean, I think I'm 100% on the level with you. I've been having similar thoughts, but I think it's probably too much to ask of most people to not follow, like, those pleasure, you know, what is that? It's like a glowing thing. It's like food at that point, even though maybe you're objectifying people.
It's great.
It just feels like an animal feels that pleasure is in this direction, so they go towards...
Listen, we're talking about a very high ideal here. The idea you're going to love everybody, you swipe on Tinder, come on. You get horny, you're hungry, you want to hump. You know what I mean?
You're not on Tinder, right?
I did go on Tinder I went on Tinder for about 3 days, on and off a little bit. Very addictive. But then I was on there and I had, because on Facebook I have my gender set as female. I think I was just showing up. So, like, guys would be swiping through girls, and then my face would pop up. So then somebody, like, tweeted that, and then I realized that if I'm going to use Tinder, then it's not going to be a private thing. You know? And then also people that I had, just, like, people who I had, worked with, or it was just like comedians. It was just, you realize, like, I don't know, man. I don't know why that there needs to be any shame attached to using technology to hook up with people. But for me, it just feels kind of embarrassing. So I stopped it. But that drive, that hunger to hook up with people, yeah, it's like one of the great forces of nature. And the ideal of loving everyone that you're going to hook up with is ridiculous. That probably isn't going to happen all the time. It's pretty limiting if you think that the only way you can hook up is if you're feeling pure, unconditional, positive regard for somebody you met 15 minutes ago over a margarita. You know, like, it's, who knows? I don't know. It's not going to happen right away. But if you just go into it with the slightest intention, at least, of making it not a robotic act, then that's great. Then you're moving in the right direction. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like you don't have to, like, turn it into a Scarlet Letter moment where you're some disgusting monster using somebody else just so that you could experience an orgasm. You just recognize that you're both being drawn together by the same primordial force. And at least accept that as shallow as you may feel about the act, you are experiencing what it is to be overcome and possessed by the force in the universe that keeps all human life here. So that's a pretty mystical experience, even if you are humping somebody that you found on Tinder.
Yeah, I don't see anything particularly wrong with that. I've never done any of that stuff, but I'm skeptical. It seems to work for some people, and then I would imagine it doesn't work for most people. That's my assumption.
You know, I've been seeing a girl I met on Twitter.
Sweet. Yeah, you mentioned this. You're in a new relationship.
I don't know if it's a relationship. Well, everything's a relationship. I guess it is a relationship, but it's not a, I don't know. We haven't, like, had the talk or any kind of talk yet. It's like we've just been hanging out and having fun, and that solely happened through technology.
People, yeah, that's a New York. It's a New York thing. Everybody says here, I am not part of it, don't know anything about it, honestly, but everybody says that, like, in New York, you know, women outnumber men, and it creates a whole different dynamic and that people are usually dating, you know, up to five people at the same time. Like, it's just, it's a completely different logic.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That is a new, yeah, right. Like, have, like, four, yeah, always have all these options that you're, that you're open for you or something. It's, I mean, it just seems exhausting, man, but... I should do that.
I wouldn't know, but I was going to ask, does LA have any sort of reality like that? It's a different place, very different place.
I don't know. I know people who definitely like date a lot of different people at once, I guess, and who live in LA. And then there's people who are just, yeah, it's like hookup culture, but there's people who are just like interested in fucking. They're too busy to get into a relationship. They're not interested. Then there's, like, I don't know, though. I don't know how it works here, really. I'm such a recluse. When I meet people, it's always strange. Whenever I meet somebody that I end up spending time with, getting in a relationship with, or getting, like, serious with, it's never within my control. In the sense that it always happens, like, randomly. It's always just, like, something comes out of the nothingness in a place that I wouldn't have necessarily expected it to. You know, and anytime I'm like, oh, I'm going to find somebody, or anytime I'm like, you know what I mean, where you're like wanting to hook up or you just, whatever, you're horny. Those are the worst times, the very worst times. It's terrible to be driven by that compulsion. Well, yeah, I guess that's what you were talking about.
Why is that such a, it's like one of the worst feelings when someone's looking at you and they tell you that they're in love with you or some shit like that, and you're looking at them like, I met you like a week ago and you work in the fiscal department at my work and you don't know anything about me. It's like the best emotions and moments are supposed to, you know, that are supposed to be these divine romantic things can be the worst moments of your life.
Ha! If you resist, those are fine moments. Anytime a person is professing love to you, oh, thank the sweet Lord. Thank God. Be like, thank you, God, for showing love to me. Now, when you think, this person doesn't even know me, they have no idea. Really what you're thinking is like, these imperfections of mine or these deeper things, these complications inside of me, not worthy of love. Surely they can't have looked past that into a deeper place that they don't even know that they know. It is possible. And then you just accept it. That used to be a thing, you know, if someone professed, who says I love you first? Who says I love you first? That's the one who loses. The other one wins control or whatever, you know, it's crazy. And it's just like, oh fuck, I'll take the love. Do you love me?
I'm into that. I just there have been a few. I mean, you know, you must know what I'm talking about. Like, sex itself is you know, potentially one of the great, you know, moments you have in your life. But there are versions of it that are some of the worst. There's some pretty bad versions of it. But I'm thinking of a couple people I've known in my life where it's a psychotic thing or something.
Well, they're trying to decide
you're the one.
It's not love. It's they're not really saying I love you. It's not really coming from that place. They're saying to you, do you mind if I begin to modify your behavior for the rest of your life?
Exactly. Exactly. It reminds me of this when I was a freshman in college that first, I don't know if you remember this, because you were a semester ahead of me or a whole year?
A year ahead of you, I think.
I can't remember, but my class got in. I don't know if, was yours like this? The first week of school, the entire freshman class fucked each other, and then never talked to each other for the rest of the year.
Wow.
But that first week of school was like, it was insane. I mean, it was the first time all these kids had ever been out of their parents' house, so they just everybody was just constantly fucking each other. And so
I wasn't there.
Well, yeah, you weren't. Yeah, right. And you weren't there. You weren't in the same class. And so
sounds like I missed that movie.
Out of
a liberal arts college gone haywire.
To totally. Out of the carnage, this one girl rose up who, in her mind, I think, thought she could. I was just too nice, and she thought she could control me. And she decided I was the one, you know. Or yeah. And she knew nothing about me, and I just remember her realizing that it wasn't going to be that easy, and I wasn't going to be controlled that easily. And we're driving. I realized that as we were driving to the grocery store, and I was like, she put me in the back of her truck. Going to the grocery store, getting in a car was like a big moment, right? Because you were going off campus. Yes. You could go buy shit, and that was rare. And she saw, I was like in the back of her truck, and she would just take the curves like super hard, throwing me around the truck from, you know, from side to side, basically trying to break my neck just to kind of like what she was like, well, if I can't have you, you know, I'm gonna leave some marks on you or something.
Why did she put you in the back of the truck?
She put me in the back, and then she would hit speed bumps.
Why didn't you sit up front?
50 miles per hour. I don't know. Somebody else was up there. Oh, and so she was just fucking destroying me back there. And I remember going to my room. I was just too nice about the whole thing. I've always had trouble just saying, like, please go away or whatever. And she got in my bed that night. This is the punchline. And I was in a pretty miserable state of affairs, and like the pipes would leak on my bed, so like half of my bed was wet. I didn't know how to fix that, or someone would never come fix it, you know. And so I'd like sleep in a fetal position on one side of the bed, and I've got her next to me just forcing herself onto my life. And then this other girl came in through the bathroom. She'd snuck, my door was locked, but she came in through the bathroom she snuck through our suite mate's room, and she came in to hook up, I suppose. And she tried to get in bed. She came down, it was dark, and ended up like completely making out with this other girl. Wow. Who probably just didn't know what was going on, thinking it was me, and I'm pretending I'm asleep on the other side of the bed, just fucking laughing inside, like this is my weird revenge, you know, that I want this person to leave me alone, and now they're, both of these people are making out with each other, thinking it's me or something. It was hilarious. Anyway,
you don't think they arranged it, or they knew each other? It was just dark and like.
Oh, they screamed and they ran out of the room. Like it took them a few seconds to realize. But
wow, that is a crazy story, man.
But that, you know, I mean, those are, yeah, that's like some out of Meatballs or some shit. But like first week of school, always pretty good, because you're like, you're in a period of transformation, like you don't even know who you are going to end up being in those weird moments, the beginning of seventh grade or whatever, you know, those are like intense moments or whatever. But anyway, point still stands, there are times when people come out of the woodwork and they project that they need to be in love with you, and of course, yeah, it's not love, it's just yeah. Some weird, sick projection, but whatever.
Well, they're trying to trick you, and they're not, that's not it at all, but yeah, there's so, that's terrible when that happens, when you have somebody who's torpedoed themselves into your life, and you don't want them there. That's pretty brutal. It really is, and it's so funny how that can work sometimes. Like, that works for them. Sometimes people, not only does someone, like, infiltrate their lives, but they end up, like, just marrying them or having babies with them just, you know, out of weakness. It's so interesting how, well, you have to be very careful, you know? Again, it goes back to, like, when you're fucking, not just when you're fucking. Like, if you really want to appreciate having sex, learn how to take a walk. Once you learn how to take a walk, where when you're walking, you're in the moment, and then as you're in the moment, you begin to, like, recognize what's happening around you, you know, just for grass to exist wherever you're at. You know, you start looking at this, and then if you don't want to get into the fact that it's all atoms harmonizing in this perfect way, get to the point where you can find what's psychedelic about it. Recognize, like, pull off everything that you have been putting out into the universe to create a safe little grid. Pull that off and then look at what's fucking happening. Really look at what's happening. You know, spring's the perfect time to do this because you can stand and look at flowers and play around with the idea that in every bit of space around you is the potential for a flower to blossom in that crazy way that they're blossoming right in front of you. That the universe is just potential flower blossomings, potential explosions of life can happen anywhere in the blank space, and then you realize, well, shit, I'm part of that explosion of life. And you look at the flower and you realize, like, God, that thing, look at it dying in front of me. You could see how it's just such a, what it's made of is what you're made of in a completely different way. It's matter that's alive, but it's falling apart even as it grows. And you recognize that's what you are. Get to that point where suddenly you're not on Earth anymore. You're in another dimension. When you're taking a walk, and then when you're having sex, you'll recognize what it is, like the high magic that you're doing. When you recognize that you're just sucked into another person's magnetic field, you can feel that. You feel it. You can feel this, like, energy, this current running through you. And then it's a sacred fucking thing. But if you play around with high magic, you know, if you mess around with this stuff, God damn it, you got to be careful. Because it's like when you're inviting someone into your life who you don't trust and you're fucking them. Ooh, that's dangerous. That's dangerous. That's like in the old movies where if you don't stand in the circle while you're casting a spell, a demon eats you. You know what I mean? Like, you got to make sure you're protected if you're getting that deep with another person. Or not. That's just a way to look at it. On the other hand, it could just be some empty rutting that we're all doing because we're monkey descendants who are slowly dying, and there's nothing after this or before this, and there's nothing that very special about planet Earth or any life exploding out of the void. It's all quite predictable. It's the inevitable thing that happens when a universe begins to expand and cool down.
So you are, and you don't have to answer this directly if it's at all uncomfortable, but so you're in that little crease, that area of time where you are in a new relationship and you are somewhere in between that, the beginning thing, the fucking stuff, and then like deciding, having to decide if you're in love. You're like in the very, very, very beginning, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been trying to practice being in the moment with it, and what you want to do is you want to eventually stop doing the exact same thing you always do, you know, with everything. And so, you know, getting into a relationship, I hesitate to use that word in the same way I don't want to use the word God or enlightenment or love. It's just like, it's bad magic. It's like, when you say, oh, this is a relationship, what you've done is cast a spell. By the way, you know where the term glamour comes from?
Do not.
Or grammar, rather? Glamour. It's like grammar is like a term that referred to like magic, the working of magic. So it's, and you know, the Book of John, in the beginning was the Word. So words are tricky, because the moment you... I'm not saying, like, the secret, if you say the right series of words into the world, then a leprechaun will come and bring you a new job. But when you do use a word, now the thing is known. You know what it is. And the moment you really know what it is, then now it's just this... It can get pretty old. So...
Well, you don't want to deflate the magic, you know. I mean, you want the magic to live on its own for as long as it wants to, you know.
Yeah, and you want to, you know, it's everything that happens to you is a brand new thing starting right now. Whatever happens to you is brand new. So the next time you go to the grocery store, it's a brand new thing for you. It's not something you've done a million times, because there is no past. There's just brand new. This moment regenerating in every in every millisecond. It's hitting that place, man. It's like hitting that fucking place with meeting someone who's amazing, or going on walks or driving, you know, it's like, so instead of making it so that, oh, I've met a new person, and then that becomes the prime center of all joy in your life, you begin to work these new ways of thinking onto everything else too, so that going to the grocery store suddenly becomes as invigorating or potentially incredible as being with someone that you're falling in love with. It's a practice. You're not going to get there, but it's a practice, because you can get there momentarily. You know what I'm saying, man? It's like, it's this relationship that I am in with this person is a brand new thing for me, and I'm being very careful about what I say or think with it, or even I try not to even think about it. You know, I try to like just let it be exactly what it is and trust that everything will be perfect. God, totally. I sound like a total dope.
No, I understand exactly what you're talking about. I was reading a little primer on Maslow last night, actually, and it reminds me a little bit of that. But, you know, because he talks about peak experience a lot, you know.
Yeah, peak experience, self-actualization. I mean, that's where my mind's been going lately is like, all right, forget enlightenment. Like, that's a word that means absolutely nothing. What?
Good point. Yeah, that's important to remember, that this whole idea of like waking up in some permanent sense is a bit ridiculous, right?
Yeah, toss that out. So then begin to think like, so people think, you know, you say actualization. What would you be like if you were actualized? Sit and think about it for a second. What would my perfect self look like? The ultimate version of me, the highest form, not as in, think of the times you're the most happy, then multiply that times 50. Or think of the times you're the most productive, or the most graceful, or the most in the now, in the moment. Think about that, you know, like really consider that. And then you'll have all these products, and your mind will produce products. You know, so your mind will have some version of you, who knows, I don't know, maybe you're like an expert at parkour now, or you play violin, or you can drive, or you're driving a nice car, or you're a sea captain, or you're a fucking holy sorceress on a tower somewhere. Who knows what it is? But, so now you're in the future. So now you're thinking about results, 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 results. The idea is like to recognize that in this moment, right now, you can become actualized. In this moment, you can begin to move in the direction of the perfect self. You know, that you can begin to, like, actually in this very moment, forgive your imperfection. That's the first step, right? It would be to, like, come fully to terms with the, not just the awesome aspects of yourself, but the flaws as well. That would be in the moment actualizing yourself. And then if you begin that practice, then you would begin to start producing all the stuff that would lead to you being, like, a great parkour expert or whatever. You know, you'd probably stop drinking a little less. You'd probably stop doing anything that began to, like, move you away from this trajectory of waking up, you know? And so then drinking becomes, like, when you're drinking, for example, or addictive behavior, it's slowing you down. You know, you're like, oh, this is, like, lowering my, this is actually lowering my velocity. And so you start putting it away, you know. That's really, I think, being cured, you know. And that, you know, if anything's enlightenment, well, God damn it, that seems as close to it as I can get in my head. You know, not like I'm doing that, but I think you can do it. I think right now you can just start recognizing that you're perfect. Even if you're in jail, even if you just, I don't know, shoplifted a pack of Pall Malls and are sitting in the back of your car about to snort meth. You know what I mean?
It was interesting, the opening quote of this summary of Maslow is, I never heard this quote before, I don't think, but he said that the story of the human race is the story of men and women selling themselves short. Well, that was a pretty heavy thing to say.
He was the best. That's perfect.
Awesome.
It's so perfect. And how often do you sell yourself short? How, and that, this is the other thing about it, which is like, you know, it's so nice to get sick. Getting sick is so cool because when you get sick, you get to like get better, and getting better, it feels so amazing when you like look back at how ill you were and suddenly you're like, wow, man, I am so much better than that. So in the same way, when you've been downplaying how great you are and how incredible your potential is, and when you've been like pretending you're in this limited world, and you start playing around the idea that you're not limited in the way that you thought. I mean, sure, you can't levitate yet. You can't fly. You're probably never going to hang out on Mars in this incarnation. Maybe, I don't know. But you're nowhere near as limited as you think you are. And when you start recognizing that in the moment, and not recognizing it like some logical like thing, but feeling it by coming into contact with the truth, then that's when you start when you really do start living up to your full potential, what you can really do. Everything will come from that moment. You don't even have to worry about it. If you can just hit that fucking place where suddenly you're not in a stale, stagnant hell anymore, but you're part of this explosion of life, and you're awake and aware, wow, you're going to make something incredible happen. You'll do something awesome that you can't even believe, but you will do it. It's just first you got to hit that place. It's like, listen, if you want to water the fucking grass, screw in the hose, asshole. Otherwise, what are you watering the grass with? Air?
Yeah, you know, one thing that's always really annoyed me is when people like to deflate, like, artist reality with that old, like, oh, you've got to be a narcissist. You've got to be an egomaniac to want to create blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, Jesus Christ, man. Could you throw a shittier wrench in the potential beginnings of your ability to just, you know, experiment and try something? Like, that's your fucking problem, man. That's not my problem. That's your problem that you don't believe that, you know, maybe you're worth, like, expressing yourself or whatever. But, like, there's a beauty to just letting yourself try things. You know, that so many people, and I'd say maybe the majority of human existence is lost in an endless ocean of speculation and of like a lot of sort of halting self criticisms and things like that. You know, it's like you don't have to be a fucking egomaniac, you know, to make something or try really, really hard or have ambition or any of that shit. It's just part of life. Like, let yourself fucking live, you know?
Or be an egomaniac. How about this? Be one. Have fun. Does that get you off? Be an egomaniac. We're talking about with that person who said that to you and all their ilk. These people are curse throwers, if you want to go back to magical language. So they're using language to put a curse on you. And the curse they're trying to put on you is, making you perceive reality in this very dark way, where the act of being a servant to the creative force in the universe is a self-serving, egomaniacal form of narcissism. And, of course, that's only a Satanist, only a demon worshiper would mutter those things to people, and they're all over the place. But it's fun to start waking up. So when you're at the dinner table and you're sitting across from somebody and they start cursing you, which is to say things like that to you, anything that limits you, then all you have to recognize is, like, unless they're an actual black magician and they really are trying to corrupt and infect the world, generally they're not. Usually they're just insecure people who don't recognize how powerful they are. But when they start saying that to you, just recognize that they don't even know what they're doing. Their magic is weak. And then what you do is you start reflecting back to them something that, if possible, will shift their perspective. Put a spell back on them, you know? If you can, try to, like, shift that paradigm around in their minds. Or, if you can't do that, just stop listening to them. Because they're trying to, like, put their you know, infected magical proboscis deep into your heart. So just, like, don't listen to them and don't get around them. But you just, some, quite often you can flip those people around in a second. You can, like, actually spin them so that they're not going around to everyone trying to shit all over their fucking musical equipment or whatever it is they're trying to dilute or pollute. Be an egomaniac. It's fun. Imagine where you're happiest. Is it when you're being an egomaniacal shithead? That is possible. You could be really happy being an egomaniac. If that's where you're happy, go there, man. Just cut away everything that's keeping you from experiencing joy. And do it. And if that means being some puffed up turd, fine. But I have a feeling that if you're really hitting your true, like, you're really hitting your, you're really plugging into the thing that makes you happy, you're not going to be an egomaniac, you know? You don't have time, you won't, it's just like being at an ice cream shop and eating gum off the ground.
That's good. Good advice. If there's something good that can come from a podcast, I suppose it would be, you know, telling people, you know, helping them strengthen whatever individualist, unique, private piece of themselves they've been oppressing. You know, I had people tell me, "You can't do that." You know, when I was a kid, when I was making music and stuff, literally, like, put on the headphones, listen, put them down. You can't do that. Fuck you. Fuck those people. Yeah. I mean, I will admit, there was a shade of it that I appreciated. That there was a shade of like, someone doubting what I could do. I was lucky I was angry enough and I was maybe self-possessed enough that I wanted to defy them. I feel shitty for the people out there that truly get fucked with and maybe held back by their parents or people around them, but you know, I mean, to tell people they can't do something, it's just fucking absurd, you know.
Well, yeah, that's sometimes, yeah, I know what you're saying though, how sometimes it's a gift where it's like you've been given this like awesome pull-up bar. Because when someone tells you not to do something and then you begin to succeed at the thing they told you not to do, I mean, what's better? That's a great fucking feeling to run into those people and be like, "Oh, how have you been? I'm great. I'm doing great. That thing you told me not to do, it's really, really working out for me." So, you know, and that's, look, I know that's malicious or it's like a, you know, a bittersweet joy, but it is a joy. And sometimes those people don't even recognize that they were being servants of God coming to you to make you a better artist. They don't even know that. They're so hypnotized and in a trance, they don't know that they're actually working for the creative intelligence of the universe. And by coming to an artist and telling them they couldn't do it, they just thrown gasoline on the flames, you know? And
Definitely. It's all part of the larger plan. Meeting those people is usually probably some weird part of the recipe of what makes you stubborn and great at what you do, potentially. Are you still writing right now, book?
Yeah, I'm writing. Yeah, writing the book. Been writing every day, listening to Pressfield's The War of Art. Fuck, it's good. And that helps write. That helps me write a lot. And then, yeah, so I'm working on all these essays. You know, it's the thing is, it's a books are slow. They don't happen really fast, and I'm in no hurry to put the thing out. I want it to be good, so that's going to take probably another 30 to 50 years of writing before it gets there. So posthumously? How do you say it?
Posthumously, yeah.
Posthumously! Yeah, maybe then, but I don't know. I don't know. It's great. The way I see it is, and Pressfield talks about this a lot, it's like, once you remove yourself from results-oriented behavior and start, like, trying to be in the process and recognize the thing as a process so that when you're writing every day, there's not a real result that you're trying to get out of it other than the result that's happening right there, which is that finally you're fucking writing. You've been putting off all this shit, and now you're finally doing it. So that feels great. And if you just that, if you make that your reward, then usually the writing becomes much more tolerable than if you're sitting down with some, you know, I'm going to write a fucking book today. Yeah, this is going to be a book. It's usually, I don't know. I think there's all many different approaches to it, but it's just eliminating the idea of some result from your activity. Boy, that makes things interesting.
Did you say you have an editor already? These are selfish questions. I want to know.
Why are you? Do you know an editor?
I want an editor, but I don't know what that would mean because I don't know what they. Like, I don't know how I would pay an editor.
I don't know, man. I think you have to like you. There's different. I think depending on. I don't know. I wonder if sometimes if you go to a publisher and they're going to publish your book, if they then assign an editor to you. That helps you, like, that you can send your shit to.
Yeah, that makes sense that it would be within the budget. But you don't know who you're going to give it to, right? You're going to write the whole book and then you're going to pitch it to somebody?
Yeah, well, yeah. My agents, the literary department at my agency, wants me to produce 50 pages or 40 pages that they could show a publisher what it would be like, because I'm a kind of, you know, I'm an obscure comedian. I'm not a writer. So I guess they need proof that it's not just going to be like, you know, just absolute shit. You know, I guess that's it. I don't know. So once I get a few essays done and I get it polished up, I'll probably give it to them and then let them handle finding a publisher. You know, part of me wants to just self-publish it, but the writer friends of mine have said that you want to get it published, and like, I don't know, because I don't know why. I don't know. It's a whole different business. See, you start thinking about fucking publishing the goddamn thing, and what the cover's gonna look like, and you know what I mean? Like, it sucks. God, you gotta remove yourself from that shit as much as possible. You know, I know you need plans and stuff, but I figure, look, if I, you know, maintain some discipline, keep working on this thing, get some funny essays out, get the beginning of a funny book out, then everything will work out in just the right way. But I can't think about it too much. Maybe I should, though. Maybe I'm not taking it seriously enough. There's something to be said for that, goals and all.
I don't know. I exist in a form of functional schizophrenia all the time because I'm my own, to some degree, I guess I'm my own agent and my own producer and my own, so I have to flip into different modes of thinking all the time, so I have to be able to do it really fast. I have to be a writer for 5 minutes and then switch to, you know, editor, then I have to tell the writer that this part sucks, then I have to go over to the video production person who's the other part of me, and then I have to go to the label part that's like, yeah, I don't like any of this in this way and this is why, and you know, and then I have to go to the live playing person, and then I have to turn into the, you know, so like I've gotten used to over the years trying to form a system of potential objectivity between the different states of mind, because I have to, you know, just no other choice. So I think you just get comfortable with it, like you get comfortable being on stage, which at first feels awkward, but yeah. You just get comfortable with it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. It's all, you know, every piece of it is beautiful. And then from the business side to the editing side to the creative side, it's just recognizing that all the slices of the pie are made of the same stuff, even if they're shaped differently, which is a weird pie. I don't know how they cut it in that example. But it's like, you want to recognize that the whole, you know, it's all the same thing. It's just different, probably different states of heaviness, you know? Like, it begins to crystallize. So that you have the initial explosion of whatever it is you're writing, and then you go back and refine that, and then that starts taking on a form. And you refine it even more, and then that's when you end up, it crystallizes all the way to the point where you're like talking business. And now you're like getting money for it. And that's where things get really, you know, if you aren't careful, then you could become one of those people who just as a instinctive response, roll their eyes at the idea of money, or like, ah, you sold out. You sold out. Yeah, I mean,
that part of the process, there's something to be said for being good at that part of the process. I don't understand. I mean, I guess I'm old enough to know and have experience, but like, I don't understand why so many people are like, you know, define themselves as this kind of an artist. And like, I don't worry myself with those. That's not my job. The well, you know what? It might be your job, you know?
I would never soil my hands with the dirt.
I mean, that's your responsibility to protect, look out for your art, your creation, and then and know where you want to put it in the world too. You know, like, just because you think someone else is going to do that for you isn't going to lead to a better result. That's what you have to know. You know, that's like.
But there is something pleasurable. That's kind of a truly like narcissistic fantasy, is to be like the savant who can't do anything, wears diapers, shits himself every day, but writes the most beautiful things ever while people are like wiping his ass and rubbing oil into his feet, bringing him groceries. He's just this fountain of genius, and he just can't control himself. And then everyone's taking care of him. That's a fun game that some people play. They get into relationships with alcoholic pseudo artists who have convinced them that they're so brilliant that they need help in every step of the way because they're incompetent, but they're just fucking drug addict idiots. I've heard stories about that so many times, man. It's a funny, funny game where you get with somebody, you convince them that you're this brilliant drug addict who is like so into heroin, but is creating such amazing works of true art. But oh God, you must save me from myself. Protect me, would you? There's stories of that with Elliot Smith, where like, you know, people would have to bring him heroin in the studio. And it's just a game, because it's fun. What's more fun than that? Being some like super intelligent thing that everyone's worshiping by enabling you being a dick? I wouldn't want to do that. But it's a very popular game. Lots of people. I bet some people listening to this are playing it right now.
I have that voice, although I totally agree with you, and I have always been kind of like a blue-collar, like, hardcore workaholic or whatever in terms of art. But I have that voice, too. Like, I was lying in bed, totally naked, drinking wine out of a wine bottle. I don't use glasses most of the time, and I'm just like like a hobo. I'm drinking right out of the wine bottle in bed naked, and it occurred to me that someone else doing this in a moment might look kind of disgusting or something. I was like, oh, does this look, is this like gross? But there's a part of my brain that goes, like, I'm a fucking artist, man. I can do this. I'm allowed to do this. Like, if my room's messy, you know, I have a part of my brain will say, well, I'm an artist, you know? It's that I'm busy. I've got things to do.
Yeah, you do get to do that. It's just, it all comes down to, like, I have to ask myself, like, is this conducive to what I'm currently engaged in? You know, if what am I, whatever I'm trying to make, is this thing, whatever the feeling state that I'm putting myself in, is it conducive to what I'm trying to make? You know, so, like, I know that, like, getting drunk is not conducive right now to that. So, like, I'm having to cut out booze right now because I, like, when I drink, the next day's gone. You know what I mean? Like, it's, like, fucking up my next day, and I've been trying to write more, and it just messes that up. I know a lot of people can do it. I know there's a lot of, like, alcoholic writers out there and stuff, but it's like, you have to ask yourself, is this conducive to what I'm trying to create? It's that thing, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, hooked on fucking amphetamines, you know? And he said that, I think you told me this, he said that he would go back and wreck his body again by taking them because it helped him create what he created.
Yeah. He said that I think it was writing the one book no one reads called The Dialectic of Reason, too, which is ironic. But yeah, that it was all worth. I mean, he was a weird guy. He's kind of fascinating. I mean, he was known for, like, shitting all over himself and just walking around in public at the end of his life because he just didn't care. So there's, like, a fine line there, you know, of is this guy a punk and he's just like, fuck off, everybody, or is he an insular, narcissistic freak, which mostly a lot of people thought. I also thought it was interesting, he admitted at one point that he was largely propelled to write most of his most dense, you know, academic philosophy just thinking of naked women and fucking women, you know?
That's it. He created a state conducive to what he wanted to create. You know what I mean? And that is, to me, that is magic. Magic is being in control of your mind states, or as much as you can, inducing specific states of inspiration that help you be a more and more of a conduit into this world. You know, a conduit of creativity, or a conduit of art, or whatever the fuck it is. So get yourself in states of consciousness that let that happen according to what it is that you're wanting to make. Hunter S. Thompson, clearly getting blasted on cocaine, drinking constantly, being in this state of just wildness and pure inebriation. That was very conducive to what he wanted to create. Fucking Kurt Cobain, blasting heroin every day. It was very conducive to the thing he wanted to create. It just depends on what it is you're wanting to make.
Yes, it does depend. I mean,
if you got to think about, like, fisting elephants, and it's going to help you make Sartre-level philosophy, think it. You know? Think it. Whatever it takes to get in contact with the big ideas and they come through you, it's not always going to be some romantic thing. It might be something really dumb or embarrassing. Who knows? But it's whatever it takes. The problem is when the thing that you've decided to use to make that contact is killing your meat body.
Right, so you're saying keep on drinking wine out of the bottle naked because that's what helps me.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. That is exactly what you should keep doing. And because you've recognized this helps me create this stuff. So yeah, do it. And you know the cost. You know the cost. You know if it's hurting your health, or you know if it's having an impact on your body. As long as you recognize that and you're like, yeah, I'm willing to pay this price. Fuck yeah, do it. I think that's beautiful. It's just don't do it when people are, like, pretending. You need to make sure that you have an actual grasp on what the price is, what it is that you're paying physically if you're using a substance consistently to make art or whatever it is that you're making. You have to be really honest about, like, well, here's what it's doing to me. It's making it so that I can't exercise in the day because I'm hungover. If that's happening, then it's bad.
Like, there's certainly a levels of the onion or layers of the onion of self-destructiveness that are all part of the Buddha's, you know, journey. And then there's a type of person with a fundamental level of self-destruction that's like just completely doomed. You know, that's a different category of self-destruction. I'm lucky, you know, I didn't become addicted to almost most things, but you know, so, but the, you know, that needs to be identified, you know, what level of self-destruction you're talking
almost
about.
Almost most things.
At some point.
Everything except black tar heroin.
I did pretty good. But that, you know, that needs to be identified for sure. At some point, you know, there's a, within the cauldron of maybe self-actualization, you know, like a certain dash of self-destruction is fucking part of the formula. But
oh,
then,
fuck,
you know,
yeah, it is. Not a certain dash. Come on, there's more than a few dashes in that cauldron. It's fun to drop those dashes in the cauldron. Just do it for a reason. Do it not, or do it, do just be aware of what it is, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a guilt game. It's not a thing about, like, ah, oh, I'm a bad person because I do this. It's not that kind of game. It's just this constant return to connection. And then let that guide you and compel you. It'll lead you wherever you need to go.
Right. There's something implicated in there. Like, there's this Faustian trade, the poetic obligation to push boundaries, this idea that you have to transcend limitations or something. You know, that's an important thing because it means that taboo must be broken. So you're already assuming all these things, that there is a certain recipe of self-destruction, a certain recipe of self-transcendence, a certain amount of destroying what you knew.
Yeah.
And in the opening of Be Here Now, which I will always probably mention, like you will, because it's somehow burned itself into our lives as the most important, you know, maybe one of the most important,
yeah,
Western articulations of this thing. But he's looking at this projection of himself and the boat and the plane, and they all disintegrate in the moment when,
yeah,
he realizes that he is not any of these things, that he is, in a sense, this almost other thing, this almost invincible other thing that can't be sort of destroyed or melted down like material things. He achieves like a new form of psychic power, like a superpower.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so within that, you know, certainly within that alchemical, you know, transformation into this super you, there is this, the melting down period, there's a forlorn moment, you know, there's these deaths that happen, and there are, yeah, sure, it, like, inborn within the transformation, there are some scary, difficult, self-destructive things.
The only thing that changes is that you always have that thing that you're talking about that he experienced. Once you experience it, you always have that to return to. You don't have to return to it. You can stay in the movie and get really terrified and scared and sad because those are happening. But at the core of the, in the same way, like at the core of the earth, there's apparently a molting, glowing life thing down there. There's a fucking heart, an energetic center to the earth. It's alive. It's filled with lava. It's superheated ores down there. It's crazy to think that's in the middle of our planet is basically another sun. It's a glowing thing, you know? It's down there. So, but look what's around it. Strata of just rocking, then oceans, and then around that, and then, you know, climbing off of that is like wars and bombs and destruction, and, you know, all of those layers are parts of the earth. So in your life, there's all these various layers, starting with the drama of your life and the circumstances that you're born inside of, and you can get caught up in those because they are happening. So you can turn your focus to that, or you could just keep practicing turning your focus to that molten core inside of you that is actually not even inside of you, but people just use that term because it feels as though it's at our center. But then you realize, like, oh, I'm inside of it. It's not inside of me. And you get to keep returning to that and returning to that and returning to that whenever you get caught up in the drama. You know, but it is definitely not going to shut the drama off in your life. No way. It's not going to change anything. You're still going to die. You're still going to go through a divorce, maybe, or whatever. All those things are still there. It's just the difference is that now, instead of being completely fixated and lost in this web of habituation, you're something free. And it is invincible. You said almost invincible. I think it is literally invincible. It wins. It won a long time ago. What am I talking about?
No, I agree with you.
The great one won. It won. That's what's so funny about it, because it's the spirit of revolution. It's the spirit of revolution that always knows that that matter doesn't that matter is part of it, but matter can't really control it. It's uncontrollable. It's that awesome verse where Jesus is like, "Give what is Caesar's unto Caesar." Money? Money, really? That's what's important to you. Okay. Well, keep all these little bullshit wafers. Because I've connected to the, like, to the source of air. The source of
air. Well, the source of what creates the money. You're higher yes. up. You know what I mean? You're higher up on the ladder of what created the thing someone else is obsessing over. It's like, you're just going straight to the source.
It's like, right? Chuck E. Cheese tickets. It's like, you know, a kid's all caught up in the fucking Chuck E. Cheese tickets. And you know those things you're caught up on in, man, it's only going to get you a very few things. You'll get some stuffed bears. Maybe if you play that stupid hedgehog game long enough, you'll get a radio. But it's like they're much greater things than what is in the Chuck E. Cheese. In the same way, there's much greater things than what, you know, the green little Chuck E. Cheese tickets that we call money can get us. You know, in fact, it's the stuff those things can't get us that have the most value.
Sorry, I got distracted. I think I have to decide if I'm going to come down there, and I think I can do it.
May 27th.
Yeah, I think I can do it.
That'd be great. Are you going to do it?
Yeah, I think I can do it.
Great. Did you hear that, people? It just happened. Emil Amos is going to be on my live show at the Improv May 27th. I'm working on some pretty hardcore guests, but I don't know if it's going to work out, but maybe. Keep your fingers crossed. I can't even talk about it. But
is that okay that we're even talking about this? Yeah, it's going to happen. You already... What's the venue?
The Improv. May 27th. The links are at DuncanTrussell.com.
How many people fit in there?
200.
Okay. And you think that's... you think that's appropriate?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think so. It's going to, you know, I'm going to start doing it regularly. I don't know.
Actually, yeah, no, 200 is great. Actually, if you are going to do it regularly, it's perfect.
Yeah, because it's, you know, yeah, I think 200 is a, you know, will be amazing if we sell out. I mean, that'll be incredible. I think we probably will, too. And that'll be fun. But this is a, you know, it's the second live Duncan Trussell Family Hour that I have recorded. And the first was in New Orleans. And so it's not quite a trial run, but this is going to be more... I'm working out what would the structure of a regular, ongoing, live recording of this podcast be. And I kind of want to imitate what I did at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery when we had Comedy is Dead there, and have a musician in the beginning or somewhere in there. And that will be you. And then... And then, you know, I want to get some guests that are going to be able to actually, like, talk a little bit before I talk to them. You know, so they can come out and present whatever their philosophy is. I'm thinking about that, or come out and, like, talk about what they do or something. And then, you know, then we can all just talk. And that'll be something. I don't know. Guys, don't listen to it. I don't know what it's going to be yet. But just come. It's going to be a good show. No matter what, it's going to be really fun. And I like doing it at the Improv because the Improv has a... bar right next door to the showroom, like a pretty cool bar where everyone can hang out after the show, and that'll be fun too.
Totally, that sounds great. Okay, well, I'm gonna start looking at tickets then.
Great, man, that's awesome. What are you so? Yeah, this is amazing. I can't. That's really exciting. That's something I have my fingers crossed about. Now, if I can only get Noriega to do the show.
Do you know if you're free for the next 2 days after that so we can do some work?
Yeah, I'm free.
Okay, cool. Well, I thought we solved most of the world's problems.
We did. We're in heaven. Life is good. Forget that you're God. You're going to live in hell. Lay in bed and drink wine if that makes you a better artist. Lay in bed and drink wine. Even if it doesn't, this is fun. That sounds so fun. What else?
in terms of the summation of what we've discovered?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have a lot more to say about this stuff. So let's try and do another one next week or something.
Another one of these will come down the pipes. Thanks for listening, everybody. Emil, where can they find you?
What am I doing now? I don't know. I'm on everywhere, man.
So go to, I'll have all the links.
Yeah. We'll post some, actually I have two albums coming out this month. So we'll throw up some links.
Okay. Thank you, Emil. Goodbye. Thank you. Goodbye. Thanks for listening, everybody. Sorry, the sound quality is a little weird on that, but it's Skype. What can I do? If you like the podcast, give us a nice rating on iTunes, please. And until next time, and next time's going to be with Joe Rogan and Chris Ryan, I bid you adieu. Hare Krishna.